2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And you know what I feel like doing?
Dancing?
Yes! Now, we've got a really cool show, and we're going to talk about dancing, among other things.
That's right. In RTB 101, Crystal will be speaking with philosopher and theologian Ken Samples on if scientific discovery has made God unnecessary.
And in Give and Take, Jeff will be interviewing biochemist Fuzzel Rana about DNA optimization pointing to a designer.
Some pretty heavy topics so far.
Yeah.
But first up is Culture Talk, and Sandra is going to bust a move with astronomer Hugh Ross as they discuss how dancing can help address climate change. Let's check it out.
Welcome to Culture Talk. This is the segment where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I'm joined today with astronomer Hugh Ross. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We're going to be talking about dancing, right?
Yeah, part of it.
Yeah, you're going to demonstrate, maybe?
Maybe.
Well, you actually wrote a blog article on how dancing can help mitigate global warming. Now, as a dancer, I want any excuse to dance, so I definitely want to hear about this. You mentioned, though, in your article that the amount of energy consumption today has increased significantly and that buildings account for 40% of worldwide energy consumption and about a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions. So that's a huge percentage. And, of course, we know that greenhouse gases are the primary contributor to global warming. So we need to look at how we're dealing with buildings and their energy consumption. So you write about a new technology that promises significant energy reduction. So what is this technology?
Well, the whole idea is what if we can have the buildings producing electricity instead of having to ship electricity to the buildings? And the discovery is that you can do that with flooring. Mm-hmm. So you take wood flooring, you subject it to a particular species of fungus, and what the fungus does is it eats little holes in the flooring. And if you time it just right, it's going to create little cavities in the lumber such that when you walk on this wood, it generates electricity. Mm. Now, when you walk on wood, it generates electricity anyway, but at a very tiny level. They engineered this fungus and timed it in such a way where they get a just right amount of wood consumption, mm-hmm. where they're able to boost the electricity delivered by more than 50 times.
So there's a fungus that is helping this wood become more receptive to the energy that we're putting onto it as we walk?
That's what the piezoelectric effect is when you apply pressure to a material, it generates an electric current.
So how does that relate to dancing?
Well, okay, you got this flooring, mm-hmm. and you can walk on it, you can dance on it, you could do aerobics on it, jump up and down on it. When you do that, it will generate electricity. So basically, this is a lumber treated by this fungus where they got copper wires running through it so they can take the electricity as generated and basically send it throughout the building to run your computers or whatever else you want to do. It's not going to provide all the energy needs mm-hmm. of the building, but it will significantly cut down on the amount of energy you need to import into the building.
Yeah, so then what does that look like? Because you're talking about dancing and mitigating climate change.
Well, for example, in our office here, mm-hmm. as the president, I'd have to encourage all of our employees here, hey, walk around. Mm-hmm. Instead of calling somebody on the phone, walk to their office because it's going to generate electricity. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, maybe when you take a break, actually do a little bit of aerobics. It's mm-hmm. going to help your physical fitness and it's going to generate electricity in the building. But some of our employees here have been saying, I don't want you getting after me all the time for my level of inactivity. But that's the whole point. If we are a little more active, which is going to be good for our health, mm-hmm. and it's actually going to be good for the building, mm-hmm. and so everybody wins.
So then when budgets are due, we're going to be putting in a line there for a dance floor here?
We're going to have to have wiring. I mean, all you've got is treated wood. You need to actually have some means of getting electricity off of it. If you got that flooring installed, mm-hmm. you want your employees jumping
dancing
up and down, walking. you know, dancing, doing aerobics.
That just sounds like fun.
Yeah, it does.
So what's really interesting is, like, first, it's just really pretty interesting to know that we can generate electricity just by moving on this wood. But how would you then tie that into a conversation about your faith?
Well, God has commanded us in Genesis and Job. We humans have been put in charge of this planet by God to manage its resources for our benefit and the benefit of all their life. He gave us the fungus. Mm-hmm. He gave us these woods. I mean, he's given us everything we need to actually be able to produce electricity just from walking around in the building.
That's pretty cool. I love this story. I feel like people should go check it out, and maybe that'll encourage them to do some moving.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for that. If you want to hear more on this topic, go to reasons.org and search for dancing.
Now it's time for RTB 101, where we discuss practical questions to equip you to share your faith more effectively. And here to help me talk about the question, hasn't scientific discovery made God unnecessary, is my favorite philosopher and theologian, Kenneth Samples. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, good to see you.
It's good to see you again. And I think this is a great topic. It comes straight out of your brand new book. Why don't you briefly tell us about that?
Well, it's entitled Christianity Cross-Examined, Is It Rational, Relevant, and Good? And I've been wanting to write it for a long time because in the old days, Krista, I'd get truth questions. Now I get lots of questions about whether Christianity is good, so I've tried to bring them together.
Well, that brings us right to one of your chapters of Hasn't Scientific Discovery Made God Unnecessary? It kind of rests on this idea that what we know about science and what we think about faith are two different spheres of knowledge. Maybe you can talk to us about that.
Yeah, classically there have been differing perspectives on how religion and science work together. Kind of Ian Barber presented these four views. Some people take a conflict model where religion, faith, and science are at odds with one another. Others, non-overlapping magisteria, they're separated. But I think classically, Krista, science and faith have worked together. They've had their issues at times, but most of the time they've been allies, not enemies.
Yeah, and kind of one of those pivotal moments of them being more enemies that everyone always goes back to is Galileo, of course. But, you know, neither one of us are scientists here, but I love in your book how you highlight some areas where you actually see science and faith coming together as friends. Right. Maybe you can talk to us about a couple of those.
Yeah, I think one critical idea, Krista, is that it was the Christian worldview, the broad theological principles out of the Bible that really birthed science. I mean, science was born one time in Christian Europe right around 1650, and it was the ideas that there's a real world out there, that it's good, that you can study it, that you can use the mind God gave you to study it. So the vast majority of the founding fathers of science were almost to a person, Christian or Jewish.
That's so interesting, because I don't know if that our culture is really cognizant of that these days, but that there is that historical alliance between science, modern science, and the Christian worldview. I'm wondering, do you see any areas where the Bible really strongly corresponds to what science is telling us?
Yeah, I think the what we call the starting points, the philosophical presuppositions of science, are deeply dependent on what I would call a Judeo-Christian worldview. Again, that there's a real world out there. It's not like the Hindus say, illusory. It's not a Gnostic world, the heresy in Christian history. It's a real world, and it's a world that's ordered, has patterns, it has regularity. Mm-hmm. Humans are made in the image of God and can track that order. I think the presuppositions or starting points of science are deeply influenced by a biblical perspective.
Would you even say that science can give us insight into our purpose, or that there's something more than just purposeless chance?
I think science is very good on the what and the how. not too good on the why.
Okay.
Therefore, things like metaphysical questions, is there a mind behind the universe? Do you and I have a mind? Or ethical issues or aesthetic issues? I don't think that's science's lane. I think that's where philosophy, religion, worldview can buttress the scientific enterprise.
And that's really why we all need each other, to have that
right?
interdisciplinary yeah. dialogue of scientists from different disciplines of science, talking to theologians, talking right. to philosophers, ethicists, and that's a huge part of what we do here at Reasons to Believe.
It's a critical community, and we have an integrative model, which is, I think, very nicely fits with science and faith.
Well, thank you, Ken, for helping us think through this very provocative topic. And I want to encourage all of you to go check out Ken's new book, Christianity Cross-Examined.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink, and welcome again to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific discoveries and how often they provide evidence for the truth of Christianity. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Fuzz Rana, and we're going to explore the optimization of our DNA. Fuzz, it's good to have you here today.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So we often talk, I mean, you know, at least here at RTB, but I know others do it, of talking about DNA as the genetic code. Is it really correct to talk about DNA as a computer code?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good analogy. I think we want to be always careful about maybe pushing the analogy too far. But, you know, DNA is a molecule that harbors information. Sometimes it's called the blueprint of life or life's instruction manual. And the reason is because embedded in the structure of DNA is the information that the cell's machinery needs to make all of its component parts and to direct its operations. And this information could be thought of as being digital information. The information consists of essentially nucleotide sequences in the DNA molecule. And these nucleotides could be thought of as being like the letters in an alphabet that are used to make words. And so because the nucleotides that make up DNA are discrete units, we can actually think of that information as being digital information. And that now makes this computer analogy, I think, much more reasonable. Also, interestingly enough, you know, biochemists have discovered that embedded within DNA is what's known as an even bit parity code, which is a technique that is used by computer scientists to detect error in data transmission. We also have discovered that the machinery in the cell that manipulates DNA is literally performing a computer operation, so much so that it has inspired a new area of nanotechnology called DNA computing, where people are building computers from DNA and, again, the cell's machinery that manipulates DNA. So I think this idea that DNA is like a computer code is not a bad analogy at all. It's a very helpful way to think about DNA.
So it really does seem like our DNA has the character, or at least some of the characteristics of computer code. And, you know, I spend a lot of time writing computer programs. I really love doing it. You know, and there's always, you know, there's multiple aspects I find in writing code. There's the, does it do what I want it to do? There's, does it do what I want it to do in the midst of all sorts of mistakes that can come along? And then especially the bigger the project gets is, does it do what I want it to do as quickly as I can, or basically I optimize it so that it works reliably and quickly. Do we see that sort of optimization showing up in our genetic code as well?
Yeah, and we see all types of optimization in DNA. First of all, every aspect of its structural makeup seems to be ideally suited for its role as an information storage system. But then on top of that, we also see an additional type of optimization that to me is really, really very powerful and compelling towards the idea that DNA is in life is the product of a mind. And this is something called the genetic code. And so the way to think of the genetic code is like it's a set of rules that give meaning to the information in DNA. So think about this. If we have, letters in the English alphabet and we just randomly string them together, chances are we're not going to really produce a word that has any kind of meaning. There's only certain letter combinations that have meaning, and that meaning is ultimately determined by the rules of grammar. right? And so you can think of the genetic code as being like the cell's grammatical system that gives meaning to the information in DNA. And it turns out that these rules themselves seem to be exquisitely optimized to prevent any kind of errors taking place during information transmission involving DNA inside the cell.
So as you're describing it there, you're talking about the DNA as kind of the data, and then there's this genetic code. So is the DNA the software or the hardware? Is it the data that gets read, or is it actually, in some sense, the program that, that runs things, if you will?
Well, it's probably both, because it is the data. So, but there's also embedded in the DNA instructions that then produce the machinery that then manipulate the DNA in such a way to make use of that data. So DNA is kind of a bit of both, if you will. So it's a really sophisticated computer code in that sense, where it's not only the instructions, but it's also the data itself that the instructions are reading.
So I know you've talked in the past about the genetic code or DNA being optimized for error correction, optimized to carry multiple layers of code. I know you've written an article about a new kind of optimization. I think it's on resource conservation. Describe what that is.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, the genetic code is optimized so that if a mutation happens, which would alter the information in the DNA molecule, that mutational effect has minimal damage to the DNA, causes minimal disruption. But there's another type of optimization that has just been discovered, and this has to do with resource utilization. Some of the most valuable resources that the cell can extract from the environment are nitrogen and carbon atoms. And it uses nitrogen and carbon to build the molecules that essentially make up the cell. And not all of these building block materials are equivalent. Some use more nitrogen atoms than others. Some use more carbon atoms than others. And so what happens if a mutation takes place in the DNA can actually alter the components of the cell in such a way that they now have to use more nitrogen and carbon from the environment than they otherwise would. And so the genetic code is optimized so that when a mutation happens, that the changes actually minimize the excess resource costs that the cell would be confronted with. So it's optimized to ensure the optimal use of resources from the environment.
You know, that's fascinating, because as I listen to you describe the error minimization, that the code is built so that if there are changes, even those changes still produce things that have the same function. But in doing that, the fact that it's got that ability to handle errors, the way it does it also allows it to optimize its resources that are available. So the adaptation to allow error minimization also provides resource utilization. That to me strikes me of ingenious design.
Oh yeah, I mean, when I think of the best evidence from biochemistry for the work of a creator, it would be the design and the structure of the genetic code. And and to me, it's, whenever we see information, when we see codes, that suggests the work of a mind. That's our common experience, is that information and codes come from a mind. But when we see that these systems are so exquisitely optimized, that to me suggests that this mind must be superior, must be beyond, what we can imagine. The ingenuity of the genetic code is mind-boggling, to say the least.
You know, as we look at the genetic code, the DNA that forms the backbone of all life here on Earth, we really do find striking evidence that this is actually a code. And the more we investigate it, the more we find evidence of intelligent design. I would really encourage you to go to reasons.org and check out Fuzz's latest blog on this topic. It's called The Genetic Code Optimized for Resource Conservation. It will help you understand how the genetic code works and give you great tools for how to use this evidence to go out and share the gospel.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and that it helped to equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion, and that you'll get out there, do some dance moves to help climate change.
Yeah, so you can sashay over to your phone and subscribe to the show. You can find us also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show.
And if you want to give the tunes a little bit of a pause while you're driving and get the podcast version of the show, we're on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.